Welcome. I'm Darren Kaster. You are listening to The Green Majority. It is actually green outside today. It's a lovely day. As opposed to the last couple of weeks, Kevin, we've had some nasty, nasty rain. But today is a beautiful day here in the CIUT Toronto Studios, 89.5 FM. We've got a fun, action-packed show for you. We're going to be starting the show with Corey Diamond, who's here on behalf of the Shuttle Challenge. He's going to be telling us why environmental group would be giving away free gas. That's my bait for that first one. Second half of the program, we're doing a bit of a combined feature. I'm hoping I'm not butchering this gentleman's name because we've only been speaking by email until today, so I'm going to take a wild guess here. That's Muaz Nasir, who's here on behalf of one my other chance to mangle something, the Green Khutbah, which is a Muslim organization that brings together mosques and community groups and other things like that to sort of encourage Muslims in their religious practices to observe the environment and to be do things, for instance, everything from starting community groups to just simply offering their prayers towards it. So the second half is going to be a bit of a combination because they've got some Earth Day stuff going on. It was, of course, Earth Day this week. So the second half interview with Muaz will be sort of half a sort of look at the Muslim angle on the environment, and the other half will be sort of looking at our Earth Day celebrations, both in general and the celebrations that his group is going to be putting on. Action-packed show today. Also, we have a news item, which I know that Corey's going to stick around for. Kevin's here in the studio as well. Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, Darren.
And I know we've all chomping at the bit to talk about that news item as well. It's going to be fun. I've got some extremely dry, witty, sarcastic comments that potentially perforated with expletives somewhere in there as well. I'm going to try not to swear on air, but boy, it riled me up. You'll have to stay bated breath for that one, though. We'll get right into the first feature. Corey, welcome to the Green Majority.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So why don't we get right into exactly what the Shuttle Challenge is. Now, I baited people there with a little bit about why they're getting free gas, but let's leave them wondering about where the free gas comes from for now. Let's start at the beginning. This is a campaign to encourage drivers to improve their driving practices. Is that roughly it?
That's right. It's a campaign to try and encourage people to drive better and drive less. And we know, Darren, that 27% of all greenhouse gas emissions are related to our transportation sector. And we also know that up to 50% of our own personal emissions are due to our driving habits. And when we started kind of thinking about what would be the next kind of transportation program to engage the public on, we looked at, you know, compared it to where you have a meter. And we know that Toronto Hydro sends you a bill and you've got a meter tracking your usage. We know that Enbridge sends you a bill and tracking your natural gas usage. And you get a water bill from the City of Toronto. But there's no meter for driving to track your impact and track your habits. And so we said, well, what if we could put a meter in someone's car and had them drive around for a couple weeks to get a baseline and how they're doing and what their commute, the impact of their commute really is, and then give them the tips and tools to change and to improve their impact. And then that's followed up by a challenge period where you try and beat your baseline, and that's where the free gas comes in.
Sure. So, I mean, one of the ideas there that strikes me, I was thinking about, I'm in a car, if you include taxis, maybe 20 times a year. If you exclude taxis, maybe twice a year. I'm even in a vehicle, much less driving one. I don't even have a driver's license. But every once in a while, I'm in a situation where I'm forced to think about driving, and preparing for the interview is one of them. So one of the things that I've just sort of observed, because I, of course, mine, and I know Kevin's on board with this as well, are big transportation advocates, public transportation advocates. And just the idea of, like, you know, telling people, I said, you know, we should all, my position on public transit has always been, everybody should be in favor of public transit. Everybody should be in favor of spending money on public transit, because if you're talking about, if you live in Mississauga and you need to drive to downtown Toronto or from whatever suburb to whatever downtown anywhere in the country, one of the biggest factors on how long that commute takes is how many other cars are on the road. That's so right. It's not about talking, you know, you, Corey, if you were saying, well, no, I like my car, I don't want to, okay, all right, well, you know, if you had a 40-minute drive, you can stay in your car, you can keep your car. But what if we get the three guys in front of you out of their cars?
Right.
Then now you have a faster drive to work, it's less stressful, less time-consuming, less gas, less costly. Everybody wins.
That's right. And our solution for this, and most of what Summerhill Impact does, is come up with pragmatic, practical solutions. We know that the average driver who lives in Mississauga can't just get rid of their car. In fact, we ran the Retire Ride campaign, which is that vehicle retirement program that ran for a couple of years, and we retired over 138,000 cars. And when we did that, we noticed that up to 70% of the people who got rid of an old car went on to purchase a new one. And so that's why we came up with this campaign, because we were kind of like, well, if we're getting rid of old cars and we're getting a net environmental benefit because we're retiring all those old you know, high polluting vehicles, we had to do something about how people use their cars. And you're right, if there's less cars on the road, then the people who do need to drive can do that. The other pragmatic thing that we came up with was the 10% piece. We know that we're not going to tell people, hey, get out of your cars and get into transit and everyone's going to do it. What we're asking people is to almost go on a diet. And it's a 10%, and everybody can do 10%. And you'll improve your life by it. So it's not like it's something that's bad that you kind of have to do, you know?
Mm-hmm. And so the angle I was sort of going at that with, which you picked up on very, very quickly there, was just the idea that any campaign about transit doesn't equate, you know, although Rob Ford might tell you differently, any transit or driving program or any of these environment and transit programs in general don't automatically, you know, isn't an anti-car campaign.
Right.
This is a let's reduce our cost campaign. This is a let's get other drivers. If you want to keep your car, let's get other drivers off the road. Let's reduce your costs. And have you had any trouble with traction on that sort of thing? Because there is such a stigma, maybe it's just in Toronto, but around any environmental / driving anything, people seem to have this knee jerk, you can't get me out of my car sort of reaction.
Right,
to
right. Well, what we're trying to do with this is we're trying to put ourselves into the actual drivers, into the driver's seat, you know, pardon the pun. But what we're trying to do is trying to get people and customize the message to the individual's usage. So by tracking the driver's habits through this meter, let's say somebody's driving in from Ajax, driving 200 kilometers every day to come into work. And we look at and we say, you know, it's unfeasible to tell them that they're going to, you know, go onto transit and do that. But by tracking that in the meter, we can actually customize a solution for them. We can tell them that there are people who you can carpool with in Ajax. We can tell them that there are ways to drive better by tuning up your cars and things like that. So we're not going to just blanket everyone and say, everyone, thou shalt take transit. We're going to customize the message based on the individual's behavior. And from that, you're actually going to get more behavior change because of that. So that's why we're doing it.
Now, we very recently had an interview with, and I apologize, I'm brain farting here for a minute. The guy's name is escaping me, but from Our Climate, Kevin, you'll remember a couple weeks ago where the guy that was putting the group putting the sort of cigarette-like warnings on the gas tanks.
Right.
That's a very, very different approach, but it seems to be going to the same sort of end. Do you think that programs like that, one that's sort of encouraging and helpful and just sort of like, we want to encourage you to do whatever you can do whatever you want to do, but let me help you do it better, and a sort of nanny state type, you know, sort of that sort of angle. Are those sort of things in conflict? Can they work in concert? Is it one or the other? What
right.
do you think?
I think you're always going to need some regulatory backstop to encourage a massive modal shift in any kind of environmental campaign. But I also think the future of environmental campaigns is going to be around what you're alluding to, which is around these nudge campaigns. So nudging people in a certain direction based on their behavior so that they can actually make it easier for them to take that action. And this is the exact same thing that happens every single day to help to make us and force us to consume more products and services. So you've got companies out there that are using data and information that we're giving them freely through Facebook and Google all the time, and they're using that information to sell you more stuff. So what we said is, well, could we take all that data and actually drive more better social change and more behavior change? And so through a nudge campaign, by kind of encouraging people slightly to do that, then you're going to get there. But you also need that regulatory backstop. And you know, I know we're going to talk about Joe Oliver in a minute, but the federal government has come up with some very stringent guidelines on fuel efficiency, mimicking what they've done in California. So you need that in place to actually kind of create the base, and then you're going to need those nudge kind of campaigns to create the real behavior change.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what's actually been going on. I've got some notes here as well. You've got about 800 and just shy of 900 registrants to the program so far, 175 drivers working through four cohorts. Maybe can you explain that system, or is this like a pairing system?
Yeah, so what it is every Monday we sign up, people have signed up. Every Monday a new cohort begins, and you drive for the 2 weeks, and then you do your eco driver training, and then you drive for the second 2 weeks. And so it's kind of a rolling cohort that allows us to kind of share the meters and to work out any bugs. So we did a cohort in the fall. We had 45 drivers participate. We saw a 9% reduction in vehicle kilometers traveled and an 8% reduction in gas consumed. And so far we've got 50 drivers who have completed the spring cohort, and they're tracking at a 16% reduction already. So it's a massive, massive shift you're seeing. And we're going beyond that kind of 10%. But the really important thing for me is, as I was alluding to earlier, was is the data that we're receiving. So we now know where people are driving, when they're driving, how they're driving, and what kinds of interventions are working, and we can kind of customize the messages to those drivers, which would encourage them to kind of make that shift. And we know that then longer term, we can use that information to encourage them down the road to make sure they get oil changes and tune-ups and other kinds of things, and if they're going to buy a car, make sure that they buy the most fuel-efficient car.
So one of my sort of overarching criticisms that applies to everything environmental, it's something I'm sort of aware of with my own message and with other people's message, is that, and you know, we just mentioned Rob Ford, so let's use him as an example. He had I'm not a fan of him personally. The show itself, of course, disclaimer, takes no position on politics, blah, 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 blah. I personally think he's a bit of a clown. But anyway, but the point was that the reason he was successful, or the reason a lot of people will tell you he was successful, was he had a simple message that everybody, you know, largely in general, maybe they didn't agree with the details, maybe they're not happy now that they've seen how he enacted that message, but the message was simple, people liked the message and they went for it. And that's a big problem, I think, with a lot of issues we could be talking about, your program in general, or sort of the environmental movement at large, is that there is no simple message, or is there? Is there a way to get this message into the hands of people like, yes, you've explained it and said, you know, we're not trying to get you out of your car, we're just trying to reduce your costs. It's a win-win-win-win-win. But if that's the case, why isn't everybody doing it? How can you talk about maybe accessing people that aren't prone to look up your sort of thing, or won't hear this interview and immediately go to your website? How do we get those other folks?
Well, that's right, and that's why our PR strategy was not to come on environmental programs. It was to actually try and normalize this behavior and get out to where people talk about this stuff. And, you know, people are watching breakfast television, people are driving in and listening to Metro Morning or whatever it is, and trying to get out there to where, you know, the average person is. And, you know, all of Summerhill Impact's programs have been around what I call the mom factor. How do you get your mom to participate in something? And my mom's probably listening right now, so she's probably laughing.
Hi, Mom.
But, you know, how do you get the average person to participate? And that's why some of our programs, we partner with the Home Depot on programs. Mm-hmm. We partner with Walmart on programs. We partner with Best Buy on programs. And when we were running Retire Ride, we partner with every gas company and every auto manufacturer there is, because that's where people are making decisions. And if you can get to someone when they're about to make a purchasing decision or about to turn a key somewhere, and if you can get to them at that time, then you're much more likely to create a long-term behavior shift than you are with the nanny state kind of, here's a brochure and thou shalt do this. Mm-hmm. And so we're trying to integrate as much as we can environmental thinking into the existing economic system that we have, so that you can actually, you know, normalize that kind of behavior. And it works, but, you know, we're definitely not where we need to be.
Have you tried getting on Rob Ford's radio show?
No, I haven't. I should.
Well, I mean, just under the simple guise of, you know, we can save Torontonians money. That's, you know, his big thing. So, you know,
he would actually love this program. I'm not even being sarcastic.
I should just be clear, because I've been sarcastic about him the entire rest of the program. So yeah, I'm completely serious. I mean, I think that would be something they could go for.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about, because you mentioned Home Depot there for a second. I've got another sort of angle. It was a problem. Maybe I'm just making this up, but I like to call the Walmart dilemma, mm-hmm. which is, I can never remember the guy's name. As people haven't noticed by now, I'm terrible with names off the top my head, but there was a famous environmentalist who had done a lot of really good work, and he had years of credit under his belt, and then he got hired by Walmart.
Adam Warbeck?
I believe that was it. Thank you. And what people's criticism was, you know, oh, you're going, you know, you've just been bought out and you're going to work for the devil and blah, blah, blah. And his point, which I think is very much a valid one, although a little bit questionable on maybe on what that ended up being with that particular case, but his argument, I think, in principle was a valid one, saying, where are you going to have the most impact other than inside Walmart? The whole point that, you know, people don't like them is that they have this massive chokehold on, you know, production and manufacturing. Where else can you make the most difference?
That's right. That's right. Not everyone wears hemp jeans and rides their bike to work every day. And you have to take the message to the people. And arguably, Walmart would have the biggest impact if they shifted their process. They'd have the biggest impact on climate change in the world, because their supply chain is so large. Something like 9% of all goods that come in or imported from China or go to Walmart. And so so they have a massive impact. So you could either work against them or you can work with them. And sometimes that works together. You know, it's great to have Greenpeace out in the streets saying, you know, this is the wrong way of doing things, and that kind of supports organizations like ours who are working on the inside to kind of change. So in a sense, it would be great if we worked together. But I believe Walmart is serious about this, and I believe Home Depot is serious about this, and most of the big corporations are serious about it because it means good business. And that rhetoric of the past of being, you know, jobs versus the environment. I mean, maybe you hear Joe Oliver talking about it, and maybe Rob Ford, but that's a fringe argument right now. And the guys who are serious about driving and strategic about driving business, they are taking this seriously. And so, you know, I see it as one of the key pillars of the people that you have to work with.
So we've understood a little bit about what the program's doing now. We understand what your goal is. What are we looking forward for the next year? Are you looking to rapidly roll this out? Are you looking at other cities?
So we're going to roll this out. Nova Scotia is happening next. So we're going to be rolling it out in Nova Scotia in the fall. We're also looking at finding a partner, a private sector partner, like an auto maintenance partner, to come on board to kind of help support the marketing of services that help you drive better. So oil changes, tune-ups, tire rotations, and things like that, and have them come on board. But I also see the data from this being very valuable to the insurance industry. Insurance is slowly shifting to almost a pay-as-you-drive kind of method, and a program like this can actually encourage people to drive better. And that's exactly what insurance companies want. They want to pay less claims. And so between auto companies, gas companies, insurance companies, there's a number of kind of areas where we think there's a benefit. And you know, if just 10% of the people in the GTA participate in this program, we'd see 64,000 tons of GHGs reduced. So there's a massive, massive opportunity here, and it's a practical opportunity. And so we're hoping to expand it as soon as we can.
So what about carryover? I mean, you've got the program, and you have drivers who are doing this, and you said you have sort of like a baseline run, and then your sort of education plus version.
Yeah,
I forget what you called it, but you know, your version with sort of consultation. What about the carryover? Is there any monitoring of people once they leave the program and how well they stick to it?
So there's a couple things we're going to do. We're going to survey people throughout every 4 to 6 months to kind of see if they're sticking with it. Some of the meters can stay in the cars, so they can keep them. And there's other kinds of apps that are we're working with a company called Mojo, and they've got other apps that help you identify parking spots, identify different areas kind of tied to your GPS and things like that. So you can keep the app. So from that, we can see. And then the other areas, we're partnering with a group out of Waterloo called Cross Chasm, and they've got a great app called My Karma. And based on your individual driving, it will tell you the most fuel efficient vehicle to buy. So forget about the sticker that's on the car saying that this car uses X number of liters per kilometer. We're actually going to tell you that this is how you drive, and if you purchase the Toyota Prius, this is how much you would save in a year in gas. And so we're going to partner with them and spit out reports so that if people are making that shift to a different car, that make sure that they get into the most fuel efficient car.
I think that's a really important point, because one of the biggest, we went to the Canadian International Auto Show this year, we went last year, and I think one of the biggest things where the car companies are all pushing lots and lots of green stuff. I won't get back into my rant about which ones were FOS and which ones didn't, but there's a big range. There's a lot of options, but there's a big range, I think, in the honesty or the seriousness about which the companies are approaching that. So with that in mind, do you think that is one of the big reasons why people aren't buying, say, hybrid vehicles or something like that is because of that? They don't know the actual dollars and cents. You know, they hear from one source that it's a waste of money. They hear from another source they could save a lot of money, and they don't know what's what.
And they're confused by all the messages that come from every single car company saying that they're the most fuel efficient. And so no one really knows. But we know that fuel efficiency is still in number one or number two in the reasons why people make a purchase on a vehicle. So that's still very much front of mind for customers. So the more that you can give them information based on their individual lives, and then the better you can shift them to that behavior. And My Karma has noticed that a big increase in the in fuel efficiency of the vehicles that are purchased for people who have got a report, because now it's meaningful to them. If they say, oh yeah, well, seven liters per, I don't know what that means. If you get a report that says you're going to save $1,800 a year on gas compared to the car you're using now, well, yeah, okay, that makes sense. So now the price on the car, you can kind of subtract that off the price of the car, and then you're all set. So it's those kinds of practical things that, and I think that once the car companies come on side with that and see an uptick in sales of fuel efficient vehicles, they'll want to be more transparent on the performance of those vehicles.
Okay. We're going to go to a music break and I think come back and talk about our news item, Kevin, unless you had anything for him before we switch gears here.
Well, it's interesting. So it seems like it's something that could be rolled out quickly and it could have an impact on emissions, and that's always welcome. My only comment would be is that, in my opinion, it's impossible to green the car The personal motor vehicle, we live in an age now where more than 50% of the population lives in urban centers. It's one of the largest sort of noticeable demographic shifts in human history. And so, you know, you have a better than a 50% chance of being an urban dweller now. And I see about as much use for cars in a dense urban setting as I see the need for guns. And I think you can sort of try to, and we have to realize too that, you know, India and China are putting thousands of new cars on the road every day. So the incremental gains you can get by sort of blunting or using fuel more efficiently, say here in Canada, is overwhelmed by production in developing countries that aren't using these technologies. I just think, plus, when you factor in the land use issues and the destruction of habitat with the infrastructure it takes to support a car, like the dissecting of habitat into little genetically isolated regions surrounded by highways, I just don't, outside of a city, I can see the need for personal transportation when you live in an area that isn't dense enough to support mass transit. But in any urban setting, I'm just completely, utterly, absolutely opposed to the personal vehicle.
Yeah. No, I'd say that in a sense, whereas if we the three of us could vote on what was the direction that the city should go, I'm sure we would all agree that the public transit. But I think within accepting the reality of consumer choices that we're not going to be able to flip everybody over to that plan. Not everybody likes our idea right away. So I think a mind for a transition sort of idea with eventually getting eliminating or reducing. And I think it's one of those things where if you start saying, oh, I want to eliminate the car, people have this image of like you coming to their house with the police and taking their car keys.
Yeah.
No. We want to convince everybody they don't need it or convince everybody that there's a better alternative. But I think in the meantime, it's a very good solution. But I would have to agree with Kevin that the end game should be mass public transit and not, you know, slightly greener vehicles.
And I'll add one thing to that. And that end game that is very much in focus for us, because we know that we've been talking to Metrolink since the beginning of this, and they don't have any real data on how people are driving, where they're driving, and when they're driving. So if they're going to actually put in investment into transit, and if they're going to actually try and get people out of cars, and if they're going to actually put in these tools that charge people for congestion fees and things like that, they're going to need some kind of information or data or pilot to kind of, you know, make that case. And so we're hoping that we can kind of provide this. We're working with U of T actually to kind of crunch the numbers at the end of this, to kind of provide to Metrolinx and say, you know, the public isn't that opposed to this stuff. You know, there's all the rhetoric from the politicians, but the public may be okay with getting charged a tax and then reducing their usage of the car. And here is where those pain points may be. So I'm hoping that that data can actually help in a small way lead to that utopia that that you've so well described.
Absolutely. I think that's a perfect note. We'll leave it there for music break. We're going to come right back. We've got, as Corey was insinuating there, we've got a little bit of some comments about Joe Oliver to make today. We'll see if I can, maybe the tech should get ready with the bleep button on this segment. I don't know. We'll see how that goes. But without further ado, we're going to go to a music break. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
What I know.
We are back. You're listening to The Green Majority. I'm here in studio as well with Corey Diamond, who's our guest today from the Shuttle Challenge, information about which will also be all up over the website as well, and we'll get email and contact information so you can sign up for the program, all that stuff. Kevin Varmer, of course, as always, is in the studio again as well. Nice to see you, Kevin. So today we are going to talk about Joe Oliver. Now, what has he done this week?
Joe Oliver is quickly becoming my favorite politician. He's superseding Peter Kent in his ability to talk out of both sides of his mouth. He launched a tirade recently. I guess it was at a press conference in Washington, lambasting among he chose to lambaste NASA climate scientist James Hansen for making comments about the dangers of fully exploiting the Alberta tar sands. And Hansen contributed an op-ed piece in the New York Times, and it was discussing the impact of releasing all of that carbon into the atmosphere, and it was a very stark prediction of the environmental catastrophe that would result from exploiting the tar sands, like fully exploiting the tar sands. And Joe Oliver just started pulling stuff out of thin air. He said that's utterly false. That's erroneous. He should be ashamed. He should be ashamed of himself for saying that.
And actually, this is too good. I'm going to have to read the quote. It's very good. I'm reading here. We're going to have the article posted on the website. It's a reading from a Guardian article entitled "Canadian Oil Mister Joe Oliver Condemns Climatologist James Hansen." And this is just too good. So it says, in Oliver's view, however, the scientist had no business to keep speaking out as he has. Quote: He was the one who said 4 years ago that if we go ahead with development of the oil sands, it's game over for the planet, unquote. Oliver told the audience at the Strategic Center in International Studies, quote, well, this is exaggerated rhetoric. It's frankly nonsense. I don't know why he said it, but he should be ashamed of having said it, unquote. Now, here's the point. Before we're going to let you get back to that. Here's the part that I love. I don't know why he said it. Well, maybe you should bloody figure out why he said it.
Yeah, exactly.
He's not just making it. It's not a coin toss. Today I'm going to support climate change. Tomorrow it's... He's a world-renowned expert. The guy, I've interviewed the guy. He's incredibly smart. One of the lead researchers at NASA. One of the people that you should be, whose opinion you should respect the most. It doesn't mean take his personal opinions on personal social issues or anything like that. But this is his area of study. He's one of the world's most knowledgeable single individuals that you could possibly ask about climate change. It's like, well, I don't know why he would say that. Ask him. Exactly. Ask him why he said it.
Exactly. Exactly. It's and just the fact that Joe Oliver was in Washington. Why was Joe Oliver in Washington? Well, he was there trying to get access for the Alberta bitumen He was there pumping the Keystone XL pipeline. And, you know, between him and Peter Kent and Alison Redford, I think we should just get them a residence in Washington, because those politicians have traveled there so much in the last couple of years.
It would probably be cheaper for the taxpayers.
Be cheaper
to get them
for
all
the
nice condos
yeah,
in Washington.
Exactly. Just get them a timeshare or something, because they practically live and they're selling this argument that just honestly ties my rational brain in knots. They're saying, look how green we are. Of course we should go ahead with the Keystone XL pipeline. We're that green. You can trust us. So we're so green you should allow us to exploit the dirtiest form of oil on Earth and one of the largest proven reserves of oil on Earth. You know, the International Energy Agency and the IPCC both, and they might be using each other's numbers, so maybe I'm sort of double citing this reference. But currently, we're on track, from reputable sources, we're on track for a 6-degree rise in temperatures. And even the most modest projections of that outcome show an utter devastation of the planet, with humanity clinging desperately to life at the poles while the middle of the planet desertifies. And that's what we're on track for. And these are the most conservative estimates of that outcome. And we're on track for that now. So we're... And if we were to fully implement all of the Copenhagen Accord, all of the commitments that were made in Copenhagen, we might be able to blunt that to a 4-degree rise in temperature, which is still greater than the 2-degree rise in temperature that our Canadian government is apparently committed to. And they're not implementing the Copenhagen Accord. And I'd just like to remind everybody that this 2 degrees of warming that's bandied about as the goal number – What has been dropped from that estimate from that number is the fact that it's the estimate at which the IPCC figures we still have a 50-50 chance of avoiding dangerous climate change. So we're targeting a 50-50. The target goal of 2 degrees Celsius in warming is still playing Russian roulette with half the chambers loaded. And I frankly don't like those odds. Joe Oliver doesn't have an argument. The tar sands don't have an argument. That carbon needs to stay in the ground.
So Corey wants to jump in here. I've just got one quick comment. I'll let you go ahead. But it was the thing that really like just hair-pullingly frustrates me. And I like to remind the listeners, of course, as well. As you know, if you're a regular listener, you know that we don't take sort of personal runs on certain issues. We don't, as a show, have a this or that position. But what we do, the only one thing that I will absolutely stand by as an absolute position is facts matter. That is the only show position that does not change no matter what. Issue to issue, facts are really important. And Joe Oliver's position is not an expert. He's not there because he's a world-renowned scientist. He's there because he's a bureaucrat, right? He's a decision maker. His point, his job essentially is to convene with other people who actually are experts, mm-hmm. and then come to a decision that both fits within his party's platform and also, you know, and suits other issues. And of course, there's a variety of, and he's got a bit of a balancing act job. He's got to, you know, appease his party. He's got to appease voters. But he's basically slapping the experts across the face. Like if there was a debate between James Hansen and Joe Oliver, it would consist of a whole bunch of like really interesting graphs and science, and you'd learn all sorts of stuff. And then his response for the rebuttal would be nuh-uh. Like he doesn't know anything. And that's not a matter of like my personal opinion. I'm accusing him of being dumb or something. He isn't. It's simply demonstrable. He's not an expert. That's not why he has this position. So why is he even telling someone who is an expert? Why does he even have any opinion on that?
Because the way that this government works, and you recall a couple of years ago, they said they came out with that statement or that letter about radical environmental groups who are being funded by
that was Joe
foreign services. So, yeah, and it, what they do is they put a line in the sand. They say something. They're very focused on communications, and then they force everyone to react. So therefore, they own the rhetoric, and the enviros are the ones who have to defend themselves. And so it's very strategic how they do that. So this isn't just like some flipping comment. They do it strategically and then force the radio shows and pundits to kind of comment on it. And then they look like, oh, well, look at all these whiners, right? But 2 points I wanted to make. I think if we're going to be successful in this and actually make it through this funnel that that Kevin brought up, I think there's two things that need to happen. One is for Canada, we need to address the demand side issue. There isn't a need to export or to take this carbon out of the ground if there wasn't such a desire for us to use it in our cars and in our homes to heat. So the number one thing that has to happen, I think, is that we need a real strong fuels conservation strategy where you have the oil sector and the government put in billions of dollars to encourage the public to retrofit our buildings and to get out of our cars and to build transit and all those kinds of things that need to happen so that we don't have such a need for this. So that would be the first thing. But the second thing is, if we're going to export this stuff and we're going to send it in a pipeline either down to the U.S. or out to Asia, my take is, why aren't we exporting some of the best companies in the world around energy savings services and transportation saving services? There are companies, there are technologies that are homegrown in Canada that need the support. So if China wants to buy this oil, okay, China, buy the oil, but you have to buy our services and our technologies that essentially help your citizens use less of it. That would, to me, would be an energy superpower in the 21st century.
Yeah, and one of the last quote, the very last quote of the article here is, again, quoting Oliver, is, quote, "crying wolf all the time does not advance serious debate," and that was unquote. So that's his criticism of Hansen saying, and I know, it's okay, but here's the thing. I took that quote, and you could say, oh, well, you know, that's true. If you cry wolf all the time, that statement on its own is an incredibly valid statement. Except what I was thinking about while Corey was talking here was that it's like there's two essays, right? Jim Hansen has an essay, and it's like, you know, here's our idea, here's all our evidence, you know, here's all our citations, here's all our science. And then Joe Oliver has another essay, but it starts with the in conclusion section. It just goes, in conclusion, seeing as climate change isn't a concern. Like, there's okay, but where is the part where he's crying wolf? You're just asserting all this stuff, but you're implying that it's fact.
He's been James Hansen has been talking about climate change for probably at least the last 25 years, and in that time, every prediction of the climate change model has come true, and in fact, every prediction that has been verified has always been shown. It's always been shown that it's been too conservative. The ice is melting faster than predicted. The planet is warming faster than predicted. Methane is being released from tundra faster than predicted. Far from crying wolf.
Now, Kevin, just because someone's 100% right so far,
yeah, exactly,
doesn't mean they'll remain 100% right. He might eventually be wrong.
Far from crying wolf, he's been sort of, him and other climate scientists have essentially been calling coyote, and what has arrived has been wolves.
Nice. I like that one.
I'd just like to because this is really on my mind lately, I've been sort of immersed in politics this week and last week, but you know, to expect reason out of this government is just foolish. We threw out evidence-based and fact-driven policy decisions when we elected the Harper government. He has done nothing since he got his mandate except to suppress research, scientists, librarians, dissent, and any sort of voice of reason. Any sort of fact-based or evidence-driven policy making is long gone. We're functioning 100% on ideology at this point.
Yeah. So unfortunately, we should keep moving. We'll go to another music break. We have to move on and get to our next interview. I want to thank Corey Diamond again as well from the Shuttle Challenge for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll have the links to that on our website on the post afterwards as well. So I guess Kevin, we can decide this week's news. Top news headline: Joe Oliver is a clown. That's our headline for this week.
No, he's a shill.
We want to make sure we're technically accurate there. So we'll leave that aside for now. The article, of course, will be up on the website, so you can check it out later. Hey, if you disagree, leave a comment for the show. We always like opposing viewpoints, and I love interacting with people. So you can go and check us out on Facebook. We have our Facebook page. Twitter is @GreenMajority. You can go to our website where all the shows, all the show notes, links to everything we possibly do are on the website, which is greenmajority.ca. Basically, anything you just Green Majority anything, and you'll find us on any possible social media. We're out there. We have someone live tweeting as well as we go here. But that is, as I said, without going on too long, we will stop it there. So we'll go to a music break. We'll be right back in about 2 minutes, and then we'll carry on with Moisna Sir with the Great Kutba Campaign. All right, and we are back. I'm Darren Kaster, your host of The Green Majority. Kevin Farmer is also in studio today, and I want to once again thank DJ Amber Waves for providing the music again. We gave her a couple weeks off there because she was actually getting married, so I guess we forgive her for that one. She's, you know, had her hands busy. She took 2 weeks off. She's getting married. She takes 2 weeks off. I don't know who forgivable. She thinks she is. But she is back on track now, newly married, providing our music for us, so thanks very much. There'll be links, descriptions to all the songs we play today, as well as a link to her blog, which is Open Till Midnight Music Blog. All Canadian content that we play here on the show. As well, so you can check her out as well. And a big thanks to her, and a happy wedding to her as well, while I'm busy being sarcastic. However, now we are going to move on to our second interview. I'm hoping I haven't too badly butchered your name so far. Is it Muaz Nasir?
Yes, it is. You actually pronounced it perfectly.
Thank you. And I'm just going to ask you to pronounce it for me again, the actual
sure.
campaign name.
So my name is Muaz Nasir, and the campaign name, it was the Green Kutba campaign.
Green Kutba. Okay, I was pretty close then earlier.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for getting on air with us today. You actually contacted me, and I love it when people do that. So the reason I'm pointing that out is just for any of our listeners out there, if you know anyone or if you yourself think that you might make a good guest for the show, hey, email us, because most of the time I end up putting people on the air, and I thank you very much for contacting us. So we're doing a bit of a split interview today. We wanted to talk about, first of all, just in general, I wanted to maybe start with just the idea of sort of, we do sort of religion and/environment pieces occasionally. It's been quite some time. Usually our guest on that topic is Stephen Sharper, who is a worldviews teacher and kind of educationally a religion generalist. He studies religion in general, but his personal background is from a Christian perspective. So I wouldn't mind perhaps before we get into your actual campaign, if we could just talk it very generally, just about the idea of sort of the Muslim community, about Islam and the environment, about how those things are related, at least from your point of view.
Sure. Well, the tradition of Islam, it actually goes back a long time. When it comes to environmentalism, a lot of the core beliefs and teachings actually sort of have a religious thread that goes throughout history. Even if you look at, for example, the architecture and the design through the Islamic Golden Ages, for example, a lot of it incorporates aspects of religion, animals, nature, into the design. So if you look at the birth of a lot of the Abrahamic religions, including Christianity and Judaism, a lot of them were born out of the Sinai Peninsula, where conservation, for example, of water was widely practiced just because of out of necessity. And within Islam, you do find similar teachings when it comes to water conservation, the treatment of animals, fair trade, justice in terms of the environment. And a lot of this has been incorporated within the faith as it's developed over the last 1,400 years. I would say probably in the last maybe 100 to 200 years, with the sort of the rise and fall of colonialism, a lot of these teachings have sort of been lost. And it's only been picked up within the last, I would say, maybe 50 years or so. There's been numerous authors and professors out there who've been sort of going back to the religious texts, not only in Islam, but other texts as well, just to see where does the role of environment play when it comes to practicing our faith? What role do we have as, you know, practicing believers when it comes to ensuring that the resources as well as, you know, nature in general is there for future generations.
And so would you say that that it's at least in the way that you view it, is that intrinsically and explicitly instruction to protect the environment? Is this more of a sort of a general you should care for the earth in general sort of concept, or is there specific ideas about nurturing the environment? Can you get into some of the specifics at all?
Sure. So there are explicit verses within the Quran. The Quran is the main text within Islam, where that deals with water and waste. And there's also within what we call the prophetic tradition, which is known as the Sunnah. So it's called sort of like the collection of practices of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And, for example, when it comes to water conservation, he said not to waste water even if you're next to a flowing stream. So it's quite explicitly stated, you know, not to waste water. And then there's sort of indirect ways through the example of his lifestyle as well. For example, when he would be eating, he wouldn't, for example, waste any food afterwards. He would always make sure that nothing was left on his plate. So these are sort of implicit sort of examples that are there. When you go back, take a step back and you look at the faith from more of a holistic point of view, a lot of the teachings similar in Islam are similar to other faiths as well when it comes to respect for the environment and ensuring that the resources that we use today are there for future generations as well. So it's sort of implicitly as well as explicitly stated as well.
One of the one of the connections, and this is definitely and decidedly more of a geopolitical issue than a religious issue, but when people think of Islamic countries in a geopolitical sense, a lot of time what they'll connect it with on an environment sense is oil. We have a lot of oil exploitation exploitation and export coming out of the Middle Eastern region, and a lot of these countries are either largely Islamic or have Islamic governments and that sort of thing. Can you comment at all about maybe where, you know, if there is this sort of like implicit care for the environment, and just where is there where that maybe comes into conflict with, you know, driving climate change, for instance, and oil exploitation and issues like that?
Sure. I mean, that's a question that's raised quite frequently, and I think you may have to separate, I guess, the beliefs of Islam as well as how it's practiced. So just because the country may be a Muslim country, quote unquote, they may not be, for example, practicing all the aspects of the religion, you know, as it's sort of clearly written. And oil is a good example of that. I do have to give credit, though, to a lot of the Middle Eastern countries right now, because they are sort of shifting the tide when it comes to their dependency on oil. I know Saudi Arabia, as well as Turkey, for example, have also adopted a lot of environmentally friendly measures as well, just because their situation in the world being, you know, near the equator, they do have access to a lot of solar energy, and a lot of them are, for example, are sort of reducing their dependency on oil, even though they might be exporting it, and becoming more self-reliant. One example is the holy city of Mecca. They actually have, I believe it's a 10 or 15-year strategic plan to become totally solar dependent. So they won't be relying on any fossil fuels for, you know, just general electricity consumption. So they are leading the world in some areas, but oil is something that's also holding them back in some regards as well. But they do recognize that oil is a finite resource, and they do have to change their ways. It's sort of a means to the end, and that's
I mean part of where I was going with that and the idea of, you know, comparing, let's say, just at random because you mentioned it, not because I know anything more or less about Saudi Arabia than any other country in that region, but so Saudi Arabia versus Alberta, between those two examples, you know, Saudi Arabia may have like massive oil reserves and they're exporting it, and that's, you know, terrible for climate change, but if they're at least using some or much of that revenue to shore up alternatives and to do like investment in green energy and all that sort of stuff, if it's one or the other, if you're an oil exporting country and that's sort of where you get a lot of your resources from, if you're using the profit of that to build solar panels, I'm like, at least they're doing that. I mean, if all of Alberta's oil money was going into developing renewable energy such that we could stop mining oil, I'd be at least much more happy than I am right now, if not happy overall. So I think maybe there is something to learn from that. That maybe could we send some Alberta people over to Saudi Arabia and get them convince them that at least they should be investing in this for their own future, even if they have to export the oil for now.
Yeah, in a perfect world.
I'm putting that directly on your shoulders. We'll get back to me on that one.
Yeah.
So I don't want to get too far away from your campaign as well. So let's get into the campaign now. You said this is the Green Kutbah campaign, and just talk a little bit about how you're bringing together different religious groups and trying to encourage them to do a variety of actions to think about the environment for this Earth Day. So maybe you could just walk us through what some of those actions are.
Sure. So the Green Kutbah campaign, just gave you some background, was started last year, and the Kutbah refers to the Friday sermon that's typically given at all mosques within Toronto and across the world. And the idea came out just to last year, for example, the Friday sermon coincided with Earth Day, and we thought, you know what, it might be a good opportunity to bring the environmental messaging into the mosque. And we developed a website, and we had resources, and it sort of ballooned from there. The intention is that it was going to be sort of a GTA startup just to see what the response would have been. And I guess with the world of social media, it did go viral, so we had responses literally from across the world. And by the end of the two-week period last year, we had about 75 umbrella organizations as well as 75 individual congregations sign up to be part of this campaign. So this year we expanded upon it. We sort of freshened up the website, added more resources, made it a little bit more clear and easy to access. And once again, we had a great response from across the world in terms of mosques and congregations from right across Thailand, South Africa to Australia, and right across Europe signing up for the campaign. In a nutshell, the campaign sort of promotes environmentalism within Islam, and it had a very simple message this year. We sort of focused it around three C's. So the first one would be care for the environment. Care for the environment is one of them, consuming less as well as conserving more. And there's sample resources on the website. use within the Friday sermon when it comes to addressing these three aspects.
And as far as the as far as going forward, one of the concerns I've had, and again, this is a question that every single time I've had Stephen Sharper on the show is something I like to ask him as well. So fair to fair, I can't let you off the hook without asking you as well. Was that there's? I think it's more clear examples, and it may be simply a language issue. There could be 100 reasons, but one of the things that I see popping up on my YouTube playlist a lot is I'm a glutton for punishment, and I subscribe to a YouTube channel called the Right Wing Watch. And they like to play clips of all sorts of nutty Christians in the U.S., like Pat Robertson saying all sorts of ridiculous things about how environmentalists is actually a global, communist conspiracy and all sorts of silly, wacky nonsense. But there's as much as one of the things I've sort of presented to him in the past was that as much as there is a number of Christian ministries and all sorts of religions, not just Christianity and including Muslim as well, or including Islam as well, of groups that are centered around the environment like yours, And like a whole number of Christian-centered groups. But there's also sort of that other side. There's that other side of people who do the very inverse option. They use the religious texts or their religious practices to say, no, this has been ordained to us, and we can do with the world with whatever we like. Do you come across that at all? Or do you ever meet people within Islam who have that sort of opposing view and think that the sort of the world is here for us to take? Do you find that at all?
Well, quite personally, not from really the Muslim community. I mean, I've had sort of people voice their concerns on why should we be focusing on the environment when there's so many other issues plaguing the Islamic world right now, that the environment should take, for example, like a lower priority compared to, for example, world hunger and various other social causes that are out there. Speaking of, I guess, detractors. I mean, I do have some detractors from other faith groups who sort of see it as, for example, a quasi-liberal agenda thing that it might be there. But I always had an open mind in terms of the articles that are posted on Khalifa, that they're from both sides of the political spectrum. So there are some in favor of the environment, some of them are in favor, for example, of the oil sands development. And I post various views just to stimulate discussion. And that's sort of the goal of Khalifa, is to get people talking. So you may not share the same views as them, but it's stimulating that discussion, and through this discussion, inevitably everyone learns more about the other position.
Absolutely. So what, with a little bit of our sort of Earth Day celebration, just to wrap up here, we've only got about 4 or 5 minutes left. Kevin, you can jump in here if you have any comments or questions, but just with a sort of celebration of Earth Day, just as a general message, we're also doubling our interview here as our sort of Earth Day wrap up as well. Do you have an Earth Day message to all the Green Majority listeners here today that you'd like to share as far as what they should be doing when they're thinking about Earth Day? I've been skeptical in the past that a day really does do anything. Do you think Earth Day is useful? And what would you recommend people use to think about or do during their Earth Day mindset?
Sure. I mean, I do believe Earth Day, it's valuable in its own right, just because it sets the stage for the rest of the year. We can't just be environmentally conscious for one day, but if you adopt certain measures from it and you sort of incorporate it into your daily life, then essentially every day becomes Earth Day. Maybe one thing I would like to give to your listeners is that every little action does help. So, for example, if you're bringing a reusable water bottle or you're reusing shopping bags or whatever it may be, the collective actions of the majority has an impact. You may not think your individual actions in the long term have a larger impact on saving the environment or conserving, resources, but if we all do it and, if you show and you share this message with your friends and your neighbors and your colleagues, collectively it does make a difference in impacting the environment.
Kevin, we've got 3 minutes left, and we haven't heard from you in a little while. Do you have your own Kevin-style Dr. Doom Earth Day message for everybody today?
Well, except not especially. Sort of my typical rant is just do something.
Do something. I like that campaign. I can get behind that.
Do something. Write your MP. Write the PMO. I mean, I do this all the time, and I don't get much traction with it. But it's just make yourself be heard because the green majority. The name of this show came from Jordan's idea that the majority of us are green and we just don't know it. And I think the green majority is in danger of being the silent majority. And Earth Day is great for raising awareness, but there's the other 364 days of the year where it's just important to make yourself heard.
Well, and I think Muaz was kind of insinuating this within the idea that you were just saying, Muaz, that there's people who are you know, pro-environment, and then there's, it's not that there's folks who are anti-environment, it's that there's pro-environment and then there's pro-oil. And then there's pro-environment or there's pro-this. But you won't find anyone who's anti-environment. So what people are really saying, what people are really, really saying is everybody's interested in the environment. Everybody thinks it's important. Some people just put other things ahead of it, is all.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, in that sense, and that's what, exactly what you're saying, Kevin, that's very much where the idea of the green majority comes from, is that I think that if people really understood the consequences of their opinions about on things such as oil and stuff like that, we don't have to convince them to care about the environment. We just have to convince them that their concerns about oil or their concerns about jobs are, you know, there's a better way to look at it, or there's a better way of solving that problem. But there isn't anybody I've ever met who needs to be convinced that the environment is important. And I think, as my final message for our Earth Day show here before we have to go, is that, you know, and this is part of the reason why I was happy to have Muaz on today, was that, you know, if your choice of the way that you want to interact with these issues is through a spiritual sense, and you're a Christian or Muslim or a Buddhist or whatever you is, and that's what works for you, then go ahead, you know, join group. You can go ahead and take part of the conversation on the Green Chutzpah. If you're so inclined, you can look up Stephen Sharper and find some Christian-oriented groups if that's your thing. If you want to write your MPs, go ahead and do it. That's your thing. You know, there's no specific action. There's no do this or you're not doing your job as an environmentalist. But I like what you said very much, Kevin. Do something. Figure out something that works for you and do it. And I think something that everybody can agree with. But you've got to spend a little bit of time thinking about what's something that you would enjoy doing,
right?
Something that you would actually enjoy and be happy to be a part of. It shouldn't be a chore, right? For some people, writing their MP is going to be a huge chore. Okay, so don't do that. Do something else, but do something.
Right.
All right. So I think we can all agree on that. I want to thank you very much for joining the show today, Muaz. And we will, of course, have links to your website and to a bunch of references that you sent as well, if people are interested in checking out that resource as well. But I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this week's show. So we will just remind everybody that if they want to get a copy of the program, they can go to greenmajority.ca. They can also join our Facebook page as well, which has all sorts of resources. We've had tons of really interesting articles that have been posting this week. I was going to do a read through of some of them, actually, Kevin, here today, but I forgot to bring them with me. But we've had so many interesting stories that we've been putting up recently. So check out the Facebook. You can check us out at Twitter, which is at Green Majority. You can check us out everywhere. You can just type Green Majority in. You can type mine or yours name, and you'll find something there. All sorts of fun stuff. So thank you very much, and we'll talk to everybody next week.